Two of the cells are green with LKD icons. Why would two of the cells be responding correctly if the rest aren't? Her heart freezes in her chest, and her trembling hands refuse to type another stroke. Her breath won't come. Her eyes water. The server only reports the status of the cells. Only a human can open them.
Lucy?
Carrie asks, but her voice seems so far away.
Lucy, what's wrong? NSC,
Lucy responds.
It doesn't mean no status connection.
Tears roll from her eyes as she looks up.
It means not secured.
The kennels are open. 12. Quarantine Protocol. A warm red light passes over Dorian's closed eyes, then again, and again. His legs ache from sleeping in the stupid chair, and he's about to have a nice stretch when a deafening klaxon fills the air. He stumbles backward out of his chair and rolls to the ground, banging his forehead on the deck. Lights dance behind his eyes, and he crawls to his hands and knees, shaking off the pain. A melodic voice booms through the cavernous depths. It's Juno.
All personnel, evacuate the kennels immediately. Containment failure. Repeat, all personnel, evacuate the kennels immediately.
He repeats the words in his mind. All fog of sleep vanishes. Between the howls of the klaxon, he listens. He's disoriented. And in the hours since he was escorted down here, he can't remember the way out. A wrong turn will mean death. Pounding footsteps approach, the sound of a full-tilt sprint, and Dorian scrambles to his feet. The gate is one of a man, and he's surprised to see the video tech from earlier go tearing past like a star midfielder.
Hey, was that announcement?
The man doesn't stop. Dorian wanted to confirm, but the man's blind panic is confirmation enough. He sprints after the tech, muscles aching with the lack of limbering up. When a hissing sound fills the gap between klaxons, Dorian gets as limber as he's ever been. The pair hurtle down the corridors, Dorian glancing behind him into the depths. Red alert light mixes with green paint, tinting everything orange-brown. The familiar becomes unfamiliar, and when Dorian looks again behind him, he finds a black shape rounding the corner, cleanly cut from the light. He misses some of the details, but he catches the important bits. Claws, teeth, hateful lips, an elongated gray head glimmering in the warning lamps. The tech screams, and Dorian redoubles his sprint. With each footfall, he expects to feel knives slicing the skin of his back into ribbons, those long teeth on his neck. It's coming closer, its thunking, bony feet rattling the deck with each loping stride. Dorian closes ranks with the tech, but it's right on him. He can't look back, or it'll catch him. His thighs burn, and his lungs ache. He hasn't run this fast in years, but it won't be enough. He shoves the tech hard to one side, sending the man stumbling. Dorian doesn't bother to watch, but he hears it. The beast falls upon its prey, the tech's scream descending into gurgling begging. Instead of going for the killing blow, it tears at the man, prolonging his suffering. Sprinting away, Dorian is thankful for his dedicated fitness regimen. Except he's still lost, and his guide is dead.
Juno, navigate to escape pods,
he pants, and a glowing line appears on the ground. He bursts from the corridor to find a vast open area, and relief washes over him. He recognizes his surroundings. If he turns right, he'll move past the lab encampment where they were extracting Blue's secret server. He heads that direction, rounds the corner, and stumbles to the ground in shock. Blood fills the hallway. Black against the green paint, massive sprays and washes against every blank wall. Tables lie toppled, wires splaying across the ground in all directions. A severed arm rests upon the floor where it had spun away from the chaos. Five of the creatures feast upon bodies, reveling in the thrill of the kill. They're a writhing mass of oil, snapping and clawing, pulling chunks of meat away from bone as they yank corpses to and fro. His feet fight his brain. He wants to run, but the morbid part of his mind urges him to identify the victims. He peers down at them, searching for any sign of who they might have been. One of the snatchers nips at the neck of its prey, severing the head from its shoulders. The head spins in place, and Dorian, in the red alert light, recognizes Yosep's face. One of the creatures jolts upright, and Dorian scrambles backward into the corridor, hoping he hasn't been seen. In truth, he has no idea how the eyeless beasts locate their prey. There's an armory station near him, which he'd ignored in his mad dash toward the exit. Dorian creeps over to the roll-up door and pulls it upward, cursing every tiny noise that comes from the interlocking steel plates. Inside, he finds a tall locker full of various rifles, flares, and handguns. He's about to reach for one when he hears the clacking of claws on metal decking. He presses inside the locker, holding his shaking breath. The claw noises slowly close in, skittering death in the seconds between the blaring alarms. It's stalking him. He can't pull down the rolled steel shutter without it hearing. Pressed against the racks, he tries to feel his way to a handgun without knocking anything off the shelves. His fingers touch a rifle, then ammunition cases, then close around the squared-off barrel of a handgun. Without a sound, he gingerly pulls it from the shelf, cursing inwardly as his fingers find the hollow of an empty grip and his other hand searches fruitlessly for a magazine. The creature draws closer. Dorian spots its shadow on the wall with each flash of the emergency lights. Its fingers grasp with deadly intent. It's going to catch him. It's going to pull him apart like bloody dough. Gunshots echo through the corridor. "Come on, you motherfuckers!" The snatcher rockets away in search of new prey. Dorian can't quite make out the provenance of the voice, but it's a man, maybe several men. More gunshots, this time distant. Panicked screaming. Whoever they were, they didn't make it. Poking his head out of the locker, he finds only bloody tracks dotting their way toward him, then away. It had been within a yard of him. He turns back to the locker and fetches two magazines and a couple of flares, shoving them into his suit pockets. It's not a comfortable fit, but he hadn't expected to go to fucking war today. He looks down at his shitty little pistol and wonders if it'll have any effect whatsoever on the creature's armored carapace. Judging from the deaths he hears echoing through the kennels, probably not. Still, he quietly chambers around and switches off the safety. There may be other things that need shooting if he wants to get out of there alive. Removing his Italian calfskin dress shoes, he places them inside the locker. If they manage to contain the creatures, he'll be coming back for them. The waxy concrete floor is cool against his feet, and he's thankful for the silence of movement. He couldn't make a sound if he tried, and he sets off in search of a safer shelter. Maybe he can hide inside one of the labs until he spies an opportunity to make a break for the door. Or maybe, if he does that, he'll reach the docking area to find all the escape pods missing.
"This is Lucy Biltmore."
Her voice comes over the loudspeakers. She has been crying, and Dorian absolutely begrudges her that.
"To any crew inside the kennels, quarantine protocol is in effect. We've contained the outbreak by sealing off your area, but there's no way we can open the doors. If any of you are listening, if any of you can still hear me...
Her voice breaks into sobs. As she speaks, Dorian stalks from lab to lab, taking stock of his surroundings. Unfortunately, almost every one of them has a viewport for observation from the hallway. While the aliens are trained not to have an affinity for glass, Dorian expects they'll have no trouble breaking into the unprotected spaces. Lucy finishes her speech.
"I'm sorry," she says,
and it takes everything in Dorian's self-control not to shout, "Fuck you, Lucy." It isn't the threat to his life that stings so much. It's the fact that the cartoonishly bug-eyed bitch with a fragile ego fucked him over. If he dies here, he's lost, and she's won, and he refuses to let that happen. The klaxons die out, leaving him with far too much silence. Maybe Lucy thought he should have some peace for his last moments alive. He finally locates a network maintenance closet and keys the door open button. It buzzes out an error code, louder than he'd like. He snaps up his gun and glances both ways down the hallway, waiting for the galloping black shape that will destroy him. This deep into the skiff, maintenance doors shouldn't be locked. He places his knuckles to the door and gently raps, shaving a haircut. The door rips open, and Anne Wexler drags him inside. She shuts it just as quickly and envelops him in a tight embrace.
"Oh my God," she gasps. "Oh my God, it's you. I can't believe it's you."
"Are you okay?"
"Yeah. Yeah. The crew getting the server, they're... Josip."
He nods. She pulls him back in for another embrace, then plants a hard kiss on his lips. When she withdraws, her posture is commanding. She has a shotgun, and through the chamber grating, he sees the bright orange of an incendiary round.
"Don't get any ideas about a farewell fuck," she says with a weak smile. "I just wanted to make sure I got one more kiss."
"I hope it was good."
"It wasn't. We can work that out later, though. We're not going to die down here."
The contents of the closet are anything but helpful. Cleaning supplies, a few scrapers, a portable power washer with a little tank. If they were dealing with humans, Dorian could grab the lye and stick it in the sprayer or something. Then again, firearms would be more than enough to handle humans. His grip tenses around the checkered walnut grip in his hand. "Agreed. What's our play?"
"We've got to get in contact with Lucy. We don't have any wireless allowed in the skiff, but there's a comm in each of the labs. From there, we go to climate control, which is near the main access point. It's sealed with no windows, so the bastards won't catch us there."
Dorian nods. "Got to be a few dozen snatchers out there. We won't last 5 minutes in the open halls." Anne pushes some of the bottles of chemicals out of the way to reveal an electrical conduit cover, magnetic bolts holding it fast to the station wall.
"These go all through the skiff," she says. "Man-sized tunnels for the techs to make emergency repairs and pull new cables."
"Okay," he says, pulling off the maintenance cover. It's almost pitch black inside, and it's unnervingly quiet. Dorian has no doubt that the creatures could easily squeeze inside if they chose. He checks the safety on his pistol to make sure he doesn't misfire. "I'll follow your lead." 13. Lockbox. Encrypted transmission. Listening post AED-1413-23. Date, 2179, July 27th. Unspecified A. We're in system. Unspecified B. What about scanners? Unspecified A. Our contingency took care of it.
Indigo flag is flying blind. Unspecified B.
Good. Time to give these Weyland-Yutani fucks a taste of their own medicine.
An alarm wakes her. It's her medicine alarm? She hasn't heard that in ages. Marcus is supposed to take care of it before it becomes a problem. How long has she been asleep? Then Blue remembers. Her caretaker is gone. Getting her own medicine will be almost impossible for her, after being reliant on Marcus for so long. Even though it's just a few feet from her bed, she might accidentally pull out her G-tube or colostomy bag. She worries that she'll administer the wrong dose, in spite of the fact that she has an intellijector for each med, because her eyesight is failing, and she can't read the labels. Everything doubles and drifts because of her demyelinated optic nerve and atrophied muscles. She wonders how long it will be before she never sees anything again. Her portable terminal rests across the room from her, where Marcus left it on a work desk. Even though she's spent hours at that desk, with her resting body on the bed, the distance now seems insurmountable. She scoots her foot toward the edge of her bed, and her leg doesn't want to cooperate. Even if it did, she knows it won't properly hold her weight. Blue remembers the last steps she ever took, 6 years ago, at her apartment in Boston. She took a shit, washed her hands, made a bowl of cereal, and then spilled it all over her couch, trying to get back to a seated position. She'd cried when the caretaker arrived to help her into a motorized chair. What a wimp she'd been. If only she'd known how bad it was going to get. If she can just gracefully slide to the floor, she can get across to her meds and the portable terminal. She'll get herself situated in the electric wheelchair, too, in case she needs to get around. But firmly on the bed, she reaches a toe down toward the cold floor, and after a long stretch, touches. She starts to move her other leg when her rump slides free, taking her to the ground in a graceless fall. She cries out as she bloodies her lip on Marcus's chair. It's been so long since she's felt physical violence against her person. Her life consists of surfing from one wave of ambient pain to the next, and yet the blow from the chair waters her eyes. She loathes herself for her weakness. Blue claws her way across the floor on her side, careful not to let her pull out the feeding tube, her catheter, or her bag. She hasn't entirely lost coordination in her legs, and even though the muscles can't keep her upright, they can push her along the ground. She reaches the desk and climbs up the side, eventually coming level with her arrangement of prescriptions. Sitting down on the desk, she grabs the intellijectors, one by one, and does her thigh, her belly, and the back of her arm. Then she silences the medicine alarm. What the fuck is wrong with Dorian and the crew? It's one thing to take away her surrogate body. It's another for them not to send a doctor around to make sure she survives the goddamn day cycle. She checks her portable terminal. No messages. She has to get a signal to her benefactors so they can speed up the rescue and... Or maybe she shouldn't. What if they know she's blown? What if they expected her to commit some sabotage to make their rescue happen, and they won't come if she can't accomplish the task? She can't risk telling them the truth about the situation. Instead, Blue focuses on the one thing she can affect. Marcus. Suddler hasn't come around to gloat about his victory, so she can safely assume he's otherwise occupied. If she can get Marcus back online, maybe she can get out of here and connect her benefactors from the safety of an escape pod. To make this escape work, however, she'll have to get the portable cipher drive, her meds, the drives with her research, and Marcus all inside a pod. The cipher is hidden under her mattress. If she can get Marcus back online, she can easily steal her remaining supply of medicine. It's kept in cold storage in the med bay. Kumbili is in there, but that piece of shit won't be calling anyone. Next comes her research.
That will be at the center of attention right now, and Director Sudler has made sure nobody trusts Marcus. She can't just go walking around in her android body, yet there's no way to steal her data without it. When the company first gave her Marcus, she secretly opened up some of his wireless data ports. It was an act of paranoia, one that no longer seems unrealistic. The ports wouldn't respond to an open scan, but a targeted attack might reactivate him. Blue unfolds her portable terminal and begins typing. They should have come and searched her room after accusing her of malfeasance. They should have taken her portable terminal, tossed her bed to find the cipher drive, and confiscated any data sources she possessed. But they didn't. So sure were they that she was utterly immobile. And she logs in with ease. Weyland-Yutani Systems, Marcus. Trademark and copyright 2169. All rights reserved. Bootloader version 1.6.5 by Dr. Hodend. Basic motor functions, okay. Basic cognitive, okay. Basic thinking, okay. Higher thinking, okay. Fine motor, okay. Isis, okay. Osiris, okay. Set, okay. Ra, sunrise. Marcus online. Last connected 5 minutes ago. 0829. 2179, July 27th. She draws up short at the last status message. That can't be right. She's been out of commission for at least a few hours. Has Sudler been ordering Marcus around while she was unconscious? Okay, she mumbles and begins to type. If he really got into Marcus's head, she won't be able to access her pilot programs. Execute pilotstrapper.imt. Searching local neural networks. The ellipses roll past, her heart beating in time with the appearance of each one. It's taking longer than usual, often a sign that the program is missing. However, she isn't sure how long it's been since she's had to reload her code from scratch. Maybe it's always taken this long. She gasps aloud. Awaiting BDI Connect. Blue eases to the floor and crawls back to her bed, wishing she had made it to the motorized chair, muscles aching all the while. She reaches across to the Brain Direct interface gear and pulls its gelatinous cap over her head, snapping the plastic outer visor tight across her nose. She taps a button at the side of the set, and strength begins to return to her limbs. She slips into Marcus like a swimming pool, all the discomfort melting away inside his skin. It's cold here. She peers around, expecting to find synth storage, but sees frosty cubic packages lining 100 shelves. Robots work diligently by the blue lights of their barcode scanners, moving the packages to and from various shelves. Blue blinks. She's in the cold storage. But why? She runs her fingers down the bare skin of her arms, and though they're freezing cold, there is no frost on her hair. Marcus couldn't have been here long. She climbs to her feet and gauges the dimensions of the space. She's in the skiff, on one of the subdecks. Blue needs to get out of here, get back to her room and start sneaking her necessities onto an escape pod. If she leaves by herself, there'll be a shortage during an evac, but the crew will find a way. No sooner has she thought this than red light stains the air and klaxons sound out. All personnel, evacuate the kennels immediately. Containment failure. Repeat, all personnel, evacuate the kennels immediately. Blue takes some shortcuts in the run to Juno's cage, slinging herself up pipes and leaping whole floors on the stairwell. She normally keeps Marcus's superhuman abilities in check, since they tend to unnerve the crew, or make them jealous. She hoped she'd never have to field a statement about how lucky she was to have Marcus's body. Now she eschews modesty in the face of crisis, vaulting across another bundle of pipes, then leaping between two catwalks to sprint for Juno's glass cage. It comes into view, all bright lights and beige walls. She spies 8 or 9 members of the crew, frantically working at the different terminals. When she arrives, she slaps a palm to the door, her synth body's biometric access still works.
"What the fuck is she doing here?" Lucy screeches. "She ought to be under arrest. Get out! Commander, get her out of here!"
Blue hadn't noticed Daniel when she came in, but he makes his presence known. He's suited up and armed with a pulse rifle and mag sling. Marcus might have superhuman abilities, but that rifle would punch through his brain case with no trouble at all. Daniel's taut muscles coil. He looks up at Blue with cautious eyes.
"I don't know how you got Marcus back online, but you can't be here.
And you can't fire those caseless rounds in here, Commander Cardozo," she replies. "Not unless you want to puncture the hull.
You do your job, and I'll do..."
"I don't have a job," she says, interrupting. "Now just shut up and listen. You have to seal the kennels." A shadow passes over Daniel's face.
"I know that. We're doing it."
Blue takes a quick breath. This is going to hurt her just to speak the words.
"And you can't let anyone out. Those creatures, they'll take advantage of any chance at escape. Through the vents, along the main passageway. They'll get out the second they have the chance, and all of us will be as good as dead."
"Oh, that's convenient," Lucy says. "Director Sudler is down there."
"This isn't about whether or not I keep my job," Blue shouts.
She doesn't hold back, and Lucy recoils, her large eyes traveling to Marcus's deadly arms.
"You know what those things can do to us."
Daniel clears his throat.
"Anne is down there too."
Blue falters, her confidence shaken. She knows what they have to do. Destroy the kennels with extreme prejudice. But every time she tries to speak, Anne's disappointed face pops into her mind. Of all the lovers in Blue's life, Anne had been the cruelest, leaving Blue because she was depressing. Yet despite their icy professional relationship, Blue can't imagine letting Anne die.
"How many people are down there?"
8 people, Daniel says.
"We have to give them a chance to come up with something."
"It..." Blue swallows. Her whole world has come to the brink of collapse.
"It doesn't matter. If Anne is in there, she's already dead. We have to lock it up, and I need to initiate the quarantine all kill.
Lucy, make the announcement." The protocol will sever the kennels from the station and drop them into the heart of Kaufman, incinerating everything inside. Millions of dollars and 8 human lives. It's a worst-case scenario, one that will damage the orbit of the Cold Forge and necessitate an early evac. The protocol was designed for exactly this situation. Lucy's rage has boiled away. Blue can see it in her eyes. Lucy knows she's right. No matter what they do, they won't be able to save those inside the kennels, not without jeopardizing the lives of those who remain. They could call for a Marines emergency rescue, and the soldiers would be there in 4 short weeks. The snatchers will have broken out of their confinement by then.
"We have to do something," Lucy says.
Blue's gaze drifts to the ground.
"Lucy, it's the right..."
"Fuck! That's not what I meant, okay? Like, I fucking know they're going to die. I just... Like, isn't there something we can do? Like, should we tell them?"
Daniel nods. "I'd want to know. I'd also want to have a few moments of quiet before the end." "They already know," Blue says.
but maybe you're right. You should say something.
Lucy leans down and clicks the intercom key, then lets off, then clicks it again.
This is Lucy Biltmore. To any crew inside the kennels, quarantine protocol is in effect. We've contained the outbreak by sealing off your area, but there's no way we can open the doors. If any of you are listening, if any of you can still hear me...
Lucy can't contain herself any longer, and she breaks down weeping. Blue wants to join her, but she can't. Not while there's a containment threat. She looks over to Daniel, who gives her a pained smile. He's seen this before, hasn't he? There's something in his eyes that tells Blue he hasn't just lost soldiers. He's lost them slowly, impotently.
Commander Cardozo, Blue says, we've got to sever the kennels. It's the only way to be sure. If anyone is still alive in there, they'll be looking for a way out. If they can get out, then...
He crosses his arms and arches an eyebrow. You mean we have to send Anne falling into a star? Blue shakes her head. Please, don't make this any harder than it is. You don't even know if she's alive. And if someone opens a passage between the kennels and the skiff, what are you going to do?
It won't work, Lucy says, sniffing. We haven't rebuilt Juno yet. Someone has to get out there and trigger the explosive bolts manually.
Then I'm going to suit up in the turtle, Blue says. You going to help me, Commander? All right, suit up. I'll be your operator from control.
14. Severance package. Blue mashes the final stage airlock cycle, and the door opens to reveal the light of Kaufman. She knows to look away this time, but the solar load still stings her cheeks and eyes. She spins and eases out in the turtle, backing toward the star. As she clears the golden airlock doors, she glances right to see where Silver Smile had opened up the heat shields in the kennels. She'll have to range a lot further in the EVA suit to blow the load-bearing bolts. Once the section is severed, she'll have to avoid it, or it will take her into Kaufman, too. She shouldn't be incinerating her future. Her research is probably in that module, along with the samples she needs. But this is what she's duty-bound to do in a containment failure. So she fires her thrusters in short bursts, moving along the outside of the kennels at more than a yard per second. She has to get this over with quickly, or she'll lose her nerve. Anne is probably dead. There's no way to get her out. Half the crew are still depending on Blue. She knows sadness, but physically feels nothing beyond the heat of radiation. A monstrous calm settles over her bones in the weightlessness, and she knows it's because of Marcus. His physicality knows no fear, no pounding heart, no sudden watering of the eyes. He simply is, and through him, Blue will kill her only real friend. If it was only Suddler down there, she'd gladly blow the kennels free. She'd want him to know who'd done him in, too. Blue reaches the first manual junction. This is her first time atop the station with this view. Her eyes travel down the central strut, past the docked Athenian, to the crew quarters where her body lies. Working every day inside the serpentine tunnels of the kennels, it's easy to forget how large they are. But outside, the enormity of the structure is inescapable. It's like a giant wart on the outside of the cold forge. There are several dozen murderous specimens beneath her, ready to spread across the station like a plague. She fires a short burst of her jets and settles onto the hull, attaching with a magnetic handhold so she has leverage. Blue grabs a tool from her belt and ratchets open the panel, which bears a written label,
Warning. Manual separation override. Upon opening it, she finds three banks of backlit buttons. This is one of the six codes every employee of the Coldforge possesses. Docking override. Skiff access. Scuttle protocol. Juno reinit. Titus reinit. And Kennel's severance. Since it's been a while for her, she checks the instructions on the underside of the panel. Type the code. Pop the lever housing. Pull the lever to confirm. Replace the housing. Get clear in 1 minute. In the old firing squad executions on Earth, 10 men would line up, and one of them would fire a blank. No one knew who fired the impotent shot. This was supposed to keep the murderers from their consciences. In Blue's eyes, all 10 of the trigger pullers are killers. There are no fake bullets in this execution. There is no crime, either. I'm at the first lock panel.
Copy.
Lucy responds. Nothing else. No words of encouragement. Blue taps each symbol with a gloved finger, keeping her gestures sure and deliberate. She can't miss, or she'll use up one of her 3 tries. On the 4th miss, she'll be locked out. She completes the sequence, and the panel flashes an acknowledgement. Grasping the massive grip of the lever housing, she pulls. It takes a surprising amount of Marcus's strength to get it free. A steel cylinder the size of a champagne bottle rises from the heart of the panel, and Blue slides open the latch on the front. The priming lever rests inside, its yellow and black striped grip like a venomous snake. Priming the bolts now.
Copy.
Lucy's going to cry. Blue can hear the sobs in her voice. She grasps the lever, but her strength fails her. Every tearful breath Lucy takes weighs down upon her hand, staying it. Anne, beautiful and vibrant, is going to die. Blue summons her voice and closes her eyes. Put Commander Cardozo on. I can't do this if you're going to cry in my fucking ear.
Bitch,
Lucy whispers. A rustling, then Daniel's voice comes over the line.
You okay?
No.
She keeps one hand on the priming lever and the other on her mag hold. Have you ever lost men under your command?
No,
Daniel says.
Most Marines never see frontline combat. Thing is, when you've got everything from knives to nukes, most people don't want to fight you.
You always look so tough.
My mom was a Gurkha. She killed a lot of Pakistanis before she moved stateside and married my dad. I guess I'm just trying to be like her, acting like I've got a job to do. Why do you always look so tough? My dad managed a hedge fund before he died. So a real killer then,
Daniel replies, chuckling.
Blue, I'm going to help you out here.
How?
Pull the fucking lever now,
he replies, his voice like a slab of granite.
That's an order.
Without another thought, her hand does as it's told. The lever snaps down under her weight, and when she releases it, it springs back to its initial position. The backlit buttons on the panel pulse blood red. She shuts the housing door and plunges the cylinder back into the panel like an old-timey dynamite detonator.
Started the detonation sequence.
Roger that,
Daniel says.
Confirmed on our screens. 2 more to go. Now get moving.
Blue has already landed at the next access point when she feels the peppery staccato of 100 explosive bolts firing in sequence. It rumbles across the decks and up through her magnetic handhold, a silent saw tearing the station apart. She knows the protocol. Inside the kennels, doors will seal and alarms will sound. The sadness of her physical body creeps over the brain-direct interface, and she begins to hear Marcus cry. This feels so wrong, but she knows what must be done. Two more lines of bolts, and the kennels can be pushed away with RB-232's retro thrusters. The heat is beginning to register as greater pain, but she ignores it. Blue looks down at the panel, and her hands don't want to cooperate. It was hard enough to open up the first one, and now she has to do it again. She turns back toward Kaufman, careful not to look directly at it, its rays hard on her face. She's going to burn up her research to save these assholes. I'm at the second panel. Her voice is barely a whisper.
Let's get this done, Blue.
Daniel clears his throat. You need to be back here. Okay, yeah. Copy. She fits her ratchet to the first bolt, and another voice comes over her comm.
Blue,
Anne says. Alarms blaring in the background.
Is that you out there?
She can't bring herself to pull the trigger on the ratchet.
Anne? Oh, Jesus Christ, it's you, she says. I know. Look, I know you're just trying to protect the rest of the skiff, but we're still alive in here.
How many of you? Like it matters. Is there a number that will change her mind? There's a long pause.
At least a few of us. We got separated, but listen.
Panic edges into Anne's voice.
Listen to me, okay? We can get out. Do you copy that? I know we can get out without them catching us.
The image of Anne's blushing face, sweaty and sated, edges into Blue's mind without permission. The trigger on the ratchet feels like it's made of stone.
How? I don't know yet, but we'll come up with a plan.
Her voice is a rush.
Just don't.
The comm beeps to indicate a severed connection.
Anne?
Blue's voice shakes uncontrollably. Her fear has overcome Marcus's body, and she feels her own ailing form as clear as day.
Anne!
She shouts the name over and over again, but it just ricochets in her helmet, unable to penetrate the vastness of space. She screams in impotent rage, but Anne's voice doesn't return. Surely the connection wouldn't have terminated if she was killed. Blue would have heard the woman's grisly end.
I had Lucy cut the comms from the kennels, Daniel says, his voice ice cold. You still have a job to do, and that wasn't helping.
Blue shakes her head.
Maybe we should just hear them out.
If you don't blow these bolts, everyone on this station is dead. Do I make myself clear? This is a numbers game. Now do your...
The comm emits a weird squeal, like 100 high-pitched chimes being struck in random order. Daniel's voice transforms to a low moan, then a breathy whistle, unnatural in its swift alterations, then nothing. Blue recognizes what's happened. It's the loss of comms due to unreliable connections. In the early days of RB-232, the flares of Kaufman would play havoc on the radios, knocking out swaths of data during wireless transfer. It was almost impossible to speak from one side of the station to the other. But with modulation and a bit of fancy mathematical footwork, they'd fixed it. Blue couldn't remember the last time someone on the station lost comms.
Commander, she says.
Commander, come in.
No response. She keys her suit radio, switching it to an unsecured frequency.
RB-232 all channels, this is Blue Marsalis, come in.
She waits 10 seconds and tries again. No one responds, maybe because they didn't hear her, maybe because they can't. Something is wrong. She spins her EVA suit to head back to the airlock. They still have some time before they must cut the kennels free. Maybe,
While Blue is inside, they can cook up a plan to get Anne out of there. What felt like a long journey to the second panel compresses under Blue's racing mind, and she's back at the airlock in no time. She keys in her code, and the doors refuse to open. Blue tries the code again, but she notices the pad isn't even active. "What the fuck?" she mumbles.
RB-232, all personnel, what's going on? Open the skiff airlock door.
Kaufman seems to grow even hotter upon her back. Her EVA has already lasted too long. She risks frying herself if she stays out much longer. She can't lose Marcus. Not now. She bangs the airlock, its solid mass quiet against her fist.
Open the goddamn door!
The skiff airlock has access control to stop it from being manually cycled. The other airlocks don't. If Blue's skiff access code doesn't get her into this one, it stands to reason she could maneuver to another one. She checks her propellant. She had enough for 3 stops and a return trip, with room to spare for maneuvering in the middle. She's made 2 of the stops, but the trips to and from were the longest legs. If she's lucky, she'll have enough to make it to the airlock on the shady side of the skiff. If not, she'll have to walk the turtle along the surface, where the solar reflections will roast her legs. Blue backs away from the hull and fires a short set of bursts to get herself moving. The suit will easily reach 40 miles an hour, but she'll need propellant to slow down. She makes a few minor course corrections, then settles in for the drift. Getting to the opposite side of the cold forge's cylinder proves more difficult than she anticipated. Instead of throttling up to speed and waiting for her journey to complete, she has to make 6 to 8 short leaps, each correction draining more of her valuable propellant. Finally, the shadowed side of the station looms in her view, black beside the golden light of the star. A lamp illuminates the entrance of the distant airlock, and Blue nearly sobs with relief. A warning sounds in her ear as she course corrects. She gets a tiny bit of forward momentum, but the nozzles sputter helplessly as the tanks run dry. No, not now. She clicks the sticks again and reboots the turtle. Come on, you piece of shit. The tanks give her a tiny burst, but not enough. She can't even be certain if she'll hit the station if she waits it out.
Fuck!
She can't call for rescue. There's no backup for her. No one answering anywhere. She can't imagine the reason, and that frightens her so much more. All she has is a dead radio, a dying suit, and the stupid heavy turtle shell on her back. Too much of it is taken up by reflective shielding, not enough by fuel, which gives it the worst ratio of any EVA suit she's ever touched. Maybe I can use that. The turtle is heavy, far heavier than her body, and it's moving in the right general direction. Even though there's no resistance to stop it, Blue could shove off of it in the direction of the station. It would be pushed away, but inertia dictates that she'll go further because of her lighter mass. Or it might spin, and she'd miss entirely, sending Marcus's body into a slowly decaying orbit around a star. Blue unclips from her 5-point harness, careful that her motion doesn't cause much reorientation. She needs the back padding to be a flat surface, perpendicular to the station hull. Then she can leap outward and try to catch the station. Hanging on to the safety harness, she plants her feet against the flat cushions of the turtle, then twists to look up at the cold forge. The hulk looms before her, cutting night out of the day with its silhouette. Fixing her eyes on the airlock door, she leaps, and strikes the control stick with her foot. The last bit of propellant charge erupts from the nozzles, and the pack hooks onto her ankle before coming free. She launches, but spins out of control. The station tumbles in her view, and her breath comes in gasps. She has no way of knowing if she's off course or not.
Her tool belt tugs at her waist, and she draws it in closer, which only accelerates her spin, like an ice skater leaping into a triple axel.
"Fuck, fuck, fuck," she mutters, trying to remember how to stop a bad maneuver in zero-G. Unbuckling the tool belt, she holds it in one hand, splaying her arms and legs as far as they'll go. The stars around her slow down as the tools sling far out from the axis of her spin. The station stops whipping through her view, and she can actually gauge her approach. She's going to hit low, but she'll make it. Her back connects with metal, and her arms go wide. She tries to kick it with one of her mag boots, praying the sole will attach. Her body hit the station all wrong, and she bounces off toward the great darkness beyond. In desperation, she swings the heavy tool belt toward the hull, which spins her along a different axis. To her surprise, the belt hooks into something, and she jerks to a halt, her legs dangling above the stars. Taking a deep breath, she looks down. The dizzying vertigo of space stretching on forever. Gingerly, she reaches up to get a better grip, but her arm is just a little too short. If the tool belt loses its purchase, she'll never make up the 6 inches that lie between her and the hull. Gently, she pulls herself closer and wraps her fingers around the lowest safety handhold. With halting motions, she clambers up the shadowy hull toward the airlock. When she presses the manual cycle and the door opens wide for her, she wants nothing more dearly than to pop a bottle of champagne. She imagines the cold bubbles on her lips and pressing a sweating flute to her sun-chapped face. But if she did that, she'd have to drain Marcus's digestive system. He's a cheaper model, with a lactic-resistant interior and no real digestion to speak of. Then it hits her. What a fool she's been. She never should have used the chimps. Blue had the perfect Pripetens sample catcher all along. As the airlock pressurizes, outside sounds bleed into her suit. Alarm bells, muddled warnings, and something that sounds like a sputtering engine, though it's too regular. Her ears take the last sound apart, piece by piece, until she finally remembers where she's heard it before. It's pulse rifle fire, and it's coming from the central strut. Interlude. Dick. He awakens to splitting pain in his head. He's kneeling? That's not quite right. There's something supporting his back, or pressed against it. His shoulders burn. His thighs ache. Dick tries to open his eyes, only to find that one of them won't open, and the pain is so great that he aborts the attempt. Every time he tries to move his right eye, it's like someone sticks a hot needle into his brain and twists it around. There's a steady drip down his face of something warm, blood, and something cold. He can't quite place his finger on it. He's missing time. He tries to capture the last moment he remembers, but it's like grasping at smoke. He recalls finding Kambili. Kambili told them about Blue's server. Then he sat down with... No. They found the server and he was with Dorian Suttler. Dick was feeding the creatures. There was someone skulking around near the cells. Dick can't pull their face from the ether. He must have a concussion. He could have fallen, or maybe someone hit him. Dick tries to move his fingers. Maybe he can see what the bloody hell is wrong with his face. But his arms are bound up tight by what feels like coils of steel. His hands throb, almost numb, and he wonders if they're broken. Panic sets in, and he kicks his legs out, trying to stand up. Something shoves him from behind, and a hard steel edge digs into his gut. He forces open his left eye to find himself pressed over the top of a crate like an arrested man, hands restrained behind his back. He struggles again, and this time his restraints twist, wrenching his shoulders out of joint. Dick screams as loudly as he ever has, though his voice is broken and throat ravaged. A low hiss drips into his ear, breath hot and rancid, and he freezes, instantly aware of the source. Blistering pain burns the clouds from Dick's mind, and he forces his left eye open again. He should be dead. He's going to die. For some reason, the creature hasn't killed him yet. As far as he knows, it's only fucked up both his arms, concussed him, mangled his face. He'll never be able to run from it. He tilts his head to get a better look around, and the blinding pain in his right eye is followed by a stringy tug. When he was a little boy, he remembers reaching into a mailbox and finding a red-back spider on his hand. A lesser boy would have slapped at it and been rewarded with a potentially fatal bite. He'd placed his hand back on the blistering hot metal mailbox and waited patiently for the spider to leave. When it was off him, he'd crushed it with a shoe. He needs to find that patience now. Blurry words swim into focus on the crate below him. Injurious spes. He knows the rest of it from heart. Dangerous specimen. Do not open without prior authorization. It's an egg crate. The big fucker wants to impregnate him. Why does it know what an egg crate looks like? He thinks of all the times they hefted one of these past the cells on a power loader. The beasties are always paying attention. Dick almost laughs when his good eye swivels to the crate's failsafe to find it still blinking active red. It can't be opened outside of the impregnation lab, not without triggering the countermeasures inside. The snatcher wedges the spade of its chitinous tail into the space between the lid and the lock. Dick's good eye bulges. If it prizes the lock, he's going to get a face full of lye and thermite. The creature crows in frustration as the lock fails to move, and Dick expects a killing blow to fall. Instead, two sharp tail strikes come down on the hinges, like the blows of an axe, weakening the container. Then again and again the strikes fall, their echoes banging out into the kennels until the hinges lay twisted and warped from the hits. The long spine wedges back into place and pries the lid, and Dick feels the metal start to fail. As it cracks, he shoves back hard against the creature, its bony ribs digging into his back. Dick's whole body seizes with pain, but this is his only chance for escape. If he can just knock the beast loose, he might crawl away in the confusion. There's a flash as the thermite lights inside the crate, filling the air with acrid, flickering orange smoke. One whiff of the flames and acid, and he can no longer smell anything but agony. Blistering heat washes over Dick's exposed face, chapping his skin, and still he pushes back. The blast of lye is coming soon, powerful enough to dissolve his flesh. The creature loosens its grip, and Dick twists free, collapsing to the ground on his side. He lands on his right eye, finishing the job. He knows he won't be able to run, that his internal bleeding is probably going to kill him if he doesn't get to a doctor within the hour. He'll be dead before then, when the creature finishes lamenting the fiery crate. That's when a miracle happens. It tries to rescue the egg. Like the anguished parent of an endangered baby, it reaches inside the boiling thermite and catches the splash of distilled lye and molten metal across the front of its body. The egg is doomed, its deadly payload leaking from the sides of the collapsing crate, foaming white. The creature's rage manifests in a bright, piercing shriek, and its tail whips about like a spear, striking anything it can find. Dick swallows his torment and begins crawling for the door. If he can just get to a terminal, he can call for help. He knows he'll never be the same again, but he's alive and determined to make that count for something. Lesser men have survived greater wounds, after all. He's almost at the door when he spies another set of black talons.
A blow like a baseball bat comes down in the dead center of his spine. Dick cannot scream, because he cannot breathe. Through his one good eye, he watches the gush of blood, knowing it comes from his own lips.